Well, thanks for the questions. The scroll is much longer than the Treaty of Waitangi, which really says the Treaty of Waitangi was not specific on a lot of points. And some of these are very specific points, which we'll try and look at. But I thought it might be useful. I'll just read out the question, and then if the person who suggested it wants to add anything to it to help us understand the question a bit more, that could be quite useful. If you don't want to do that, that's fine as well. And some of the writing isn't as easy as my eyes are not as good as they used to be, put it that way. This is the... I'll just take them as they come. And this is, given the interpretational, I think is the word, given the interpretational nature of the treaty, how authoritative does it remain as a foundation document for this nation? Does anyone want to comment on that question a bit? To explain a bit more what's behind the question?
You've given some background historically at almost how accidentally and coincidentally the document came to be formed, and then you went on to discuss some of the differences between language and therefore understanding between the two parties. And then the mission, I think, that it was given to Colenso to actually go out and to explain the nature of the document. So we have this, I think, just a wonderfully painted picture of how it's a fragile document that is open to all kinds of interpretation. So given that, where do we place it in terms of the cornerstone, the foundation, that which we seek to build this nation upon? How crucial and authoritative do you see it as being? Is it because of its all of that that you've explained, can we put all our eggs in that basket and say, yes, this is the key thing that is actually going to help us to build this nation?
Yes, I feared that's what you meant. because it's a question that many New Zealanders are asking. Here we have a document that goes back to 1840, and one view is that its relevance in 1840 was perhaps obvious. What is its relevance, and what place does it have in New Zealand, in modern New Zealand? More importantly, beyond today, because it's not so much today we think about, but tomorrow. And there are a number of views on it. One not uncommon view, and in fact, I think that if you went and asked this question in the streets of Hamilton, something like 80% of the people that you approached, if you approached them randomly and didn't approach your friends, but 80% of the people you approach would probably say that the treaty has no place in modern New Zealand. I think that's a commonly held view in New Zealand. And of the remainder, probably 10-15% would say it should be the only document upon which we build New Zealand's future. And the others would agree, but not perhaps to that extent. So there's quite a range of views on that in New Zealand. The majority view probably is that it's not a hugely significant document for the future of the country. I think that'd be the common viewpoint. Now, here you find that, in fact, the view of the Crown, if I'm talking about the Crown now, not as Parliament, but as the executive of the government, the view of the Crown is probably quite different from the view of the majority of New Zealanders, because the Crown is in a position where it has accepted the obligations of the treaty handed down year after year as quite a binding and significant document. So I think if you lined all the cabinet ministers in the country up, and instead of shooting them, you ask them this question, my guess is that they would say that we believe the treaty is a hugely important document upon which New Zealand's future should be built. I think that's probably the Crown view. if you ask the Crown, if you ask the same people when they're in opposition about that, they might have different views. But there seems to be, within New Zealand, a sense that the Crown has some continuing, ongoing obligation for a deal that was made by the predecessors, albeit was a British government, that many years ago. So that there is this distinction then, I think, between the view of the Crown. I think that's the view of the Crown now. It wasn't always. I mean, for the most part, the New Zealand government, having signed the treaty, put it to one side. It was simply a vehicle to obtain sovereignty over New Zealand. And that's why we've got so many claims to the Waitangi Tribunal, because the Crown put it to one side. Now, I think if you ask the same question of 100 Māori people you meet in Hamilton, 85% of them would take the other view, that the treaty is very important to the future of New Zealand. Why the difference? And the difference has to do, I think, with two traditions that have developed in New Zealand. And we've got a good record in both of these things, but they tend to be clashing. Or there's the potential for them to clash if we don't manage it well. One tradition that we have in New Zealand, that every person is as good as the neighbour. We're all products of the 1935 welfare state, and one of the huge contributions that New Zealand made to the world in 1935 was this idea that everyone is equal in this country, we all have the same rights, and that we all deserve the same go, a fair go. And that was basically that the welfare state introduced this notion in quite a strong way. And we were as much a classless society then as any other country in the world. So we hold pretty dear, I think, most New Zealanders hold pretty dear, the idea that as citizens, we all have a right to the same opportunities, we all deserve a fair go, we're all equally important. And that's a strong New Zealand tradition. We were the first country that gave women the full vote, for example. So we've got a strong tradition in individual rights. We also have a strong tradition in Indigenous rights, which is what the Treaty of Waitangi is about. The Treaty of Waitangi was, of course, to be the model document which talked about how a colonising power, Great Britain, would interact with an Indigenous group. And although there have been a number of breaches of the treaty, since 1975 at least, you can find that New Zealand's record in Indigenous rights is as good as anyone in the world. That's not actually saying a huge amount, because they're pretty bad in most places in the world. But we've been leaders in many fields. I mean, since 1867, there have been 4 Māori seats in Parliament. Many Indigenous people around the world are now trying to get that. So that we've been a bit ahead of the play in some ways. I'm not saying it's been perfect. But we've got a pretty good tradition in Indigenous rights. We've got a very good tradition in equality as between individuals. Now, the question then comes up, if we say that everyone's equal and everyone has the same chances and we recognise the worth of every individual, how do we reconcile that with a particular group of rights that we recognise for Indigenous people? Therein, I think, lies the challenge. Now, the Treaty of Waitangi is one way of negotiating that. If you compare the New Zealand situation, say, with Aborigines in Australia or the First Nations of Canada, or the American Indians in USA, there are similar issues, but they're handled quite differently. And the thing that seems to make the difference is this notion that between the Crown on the one hand and Māori people on the other, there is a relationship of some priority. Now, people argue, of course, that clashes with this notion of individual equality. We need to, I think we've got a tradition in both. How can we reconcile the two so that we can continue to have a tradition in Indigenous rights and respect that without compromising the rights that all New Zealanders have as individuals? And that's the challenge. I think that's the essential nature of the treaty. Sometimes the treaty has been, I think, misinterpreted in recent times as being about Māori disadvantage. so that closing the gaps, for example, the ill-fated policy that never actually got off the ground, closing the gaps tended to give the impression that really that you can justify the Treaty of Waitangi because Māori have socio-economic disadvantage. Well, you don't need a Treaty of Waitangi to say that we should not tolerate socio-economic disadvantage. If Pacific Island people or disabled people or people have had a mental breakdown, if any group of people in our society are disadvantaged, we should not tolerate that. You don't need the treaty to argue that. So closing the gaps is not really a treaty argument, it's an equity argument. Then some people say, well, the Treaty of Waitangi is all about settling claims. In fact, the government before this one of the prime ministers of the government before this one, when asked, and there's a choice there, when asked about the meaning of the Treaty of Waitangi, said, when we asked what is your treaty policy, said we're settling the claims as quickly as we can. Confused a treaty policy with a claims policy. Settling claims is about correcting the injustices of the past. It's not about the Treaty of Waitangi per se. It's about injustice. And you don't really need a treaty to argue for justice. That's the society we have argues for justice. So that really the treaty is not so much about disadvantage or about the injustices of the past. It's about reconciling citizenship that we all enjoy with the particular position of Indigenous people. And the treaty is somewhere in the middle of those two things. How it can mediate those two important aspects of our New Zealand life, I think we're discovering. Now, that's not to say, therefore, that the treaty is the one important thing in our future, because we've got a proud record in the rights of individuals. We're a hugely proud record of that in New Zealand and make good progress with it. We have a number of ethnic groups in New Zealand, starting with the Scots and the Welsh and the Irish, and more recently Korean and Thai migrants, and we recognise them, we recognise their culture, we celebrate their culture. So we've got that tradition. We also have the tradition of Indigenous rights. Now, in countries that don't have that tradition, who don't have the mediating influence of the treaty, they struggle to reconcile these two things. Indigenous rights on the one hand, citizenship rights on the other. I don't think that answers your question. It raises some of the issues behind your question.
I think that's a good... I'll leave it at that, and lots of other questions I'm sure that you have to answer. So that's a great opening. Thank you.
With a little bit of relief, I'll move on to the next question. Which is that many Pākehā of older generations have become alienated through what they perceive as a fast-track integration of the treaty back into the fabric of our nation. How are we, Tātou, going to build an acute awareness of the treaty matters back into our multicultural society, a society which is becoming increasingly multiracial? And how are we going to do that for our Tamariki's generation, as it isn't a key point of curriculum? I think the key issue there, well, did anyone remember who wrote that? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, well, I guess I'd like to go back to your straw poll, or argument, dare I say, they kind of say it was important, and yet it's kind of a founding document, and it's becoming more of a fabric of our society. So if in our education system, we're not dealing with these issues even now, how are we going to build an awareness that means we can knit our society together in harmony, which I guess is the guiding principle behind the treaty?
I had the great fortune this year on the 6th of February, when the treaty was being celebrated all around the country, except at Waitangi. Oh, no, it wasn't, including at Waitangi. Was being celebrated. I went to a function at the Government House, and the Governor-General made a speech. And in her speech, she said exactly the question you've raised. that here we are celebrating an event that happened in 1840, and yet to many New Zealanders who have lived here all their life, they are a little bit hazy about what is the significance of the event and what actually was the event. And she said that she suspects, and I think she suspects with good authority, that the government is going to do something about that. And I've heard that what the government is planning to do is to establish a commission that will have exactly this purpose, to provide an educational framework. Now, it's been done before. There was a very important group in New Zealand called Project Waitangi in the 1980s, and that's exactly what they did. I think if we're going to do this, it needs to be done, though, in a way which the long-term aim is to build a stronger nation, not to create a fragmented nation. And, I mean, that's my view about how the process should go. And one of the important things, therefore, is to be able to be real about what New Zealand society is currently like, and then to see how the treaty can enrich that. So the treaty isn't presented as something which you hang over people's heads in the same way that I remember the Ten Commandments being held over my head, daring me not to break them. The treaty is held up as something which can enrich the life of the nation without diminishing other aspects of our nationhood. And if the educational process that's going to be embarked on this year, I understand, perhaps after the election, if that's the process we're going to do, the concern I would have is that it's presented in a way that leads ultimately to a stronger nation, and which is premised largely on the future and not the problems of the past. One of the difficulties with the Project Waitangi, although maybe it was symbolic of its time, the Project Waitangi educational process tended to present the treaty debate as a debate about grievance. It is really a debate about development. See, in 1840, people weren't really wanting to look backwards. They wanted to emphasise the forward development of New Zealand so that New Zealand stood pretty well in the wider national affairs. And I think that if we're going to have a debate about the treaty and its place and its education about it, the useful thing is to be looking at this as not about grievance and not about injustice, even though I'm not minimising the importance of those things, but about the development of the country so that there are winners all round. You'll notice I'm not actually answering any of the questions, but I'm using the questions to talk about the issues. Oh, well, academics are very good at setting questions, but not necessarily answering them. They expect the students to answer them. That's a politician. Yeah. Well, politicians change the subject altogether. I'm not being quite as bad as that, I hope. You spoke as if tinoranga tiratanga means sovereignty, control of all matters and affairs. Doesn't the second article, even in the Māori version, limit tinoranga tiratanga to the possession specified? Does anyone remember? Oh, yeah, do you want just to round that a bit? It's pretty clear as it is, but...
Yeah, I would second what you said about the treaty and its development the direction in which it's going. It is forward-looking. But there is a tendency, treating matters, among some people anyway, to work towards separation. And I just thought that my training as a lawyer, that I've long since gone from law to grace, the treaty is a very, in some ways, quite a specific document. It outlines certain things. And one of the things there relates to tina rangatiratanga as related to those very specific things. Well, the palm is not that easy to define, but that's another question. Isn't that true, though? I mean, there are a lot of things like health, there are a lot of things like international travel, there are a lot of things like the nature of government, which the treaty simply could not have interested. And when it does talk about King Arthur and Peter, it's talking about personal possessions, which I hope would be given to every citizen in New Zealand, Maori, Chinese, or otherwise.
Yes, there is a difference between the two, the flavour of English and Maori in Article 2. Article 2 in English, the flavour of it is very much property rights. And that doesn't say anything new, really. I mean, what it says in English is that if you own any property, you can keep it. Well, that's true for all of us, isn't it? That's common law, that if you own something, it's yours, and no one can take it from you unless they pass an Act of Parliament, which takes it away from you. So that is actually nothing new. That's a common law right that everyone possesses, and that's the spirit of the English article, the English version of Article 2, that if you own property, and what it says is we guarantee you the full, exclusive, and undisturbed possession of your lands, forests, fisheries, estates, and other properties. We could equally say to all of us here that we guarantee that if you own your car, provided you keep up the payments, it's yours. And your house is yours, and we won't take it away from you. The Maori version of Article 2 moves into a different plane in that it is much less specific about property ownership, and the notion of tino ranga te ratanga moves into the area of the decision-making about those. And so that it's less focused on property rights and more focused on the ability to control those rights. So there is a variation between the two. At the same time, it's one article in a total treaty. And the important part of the treaty, if you're going to look at article by article, is that all three articles are important. So the question that would come up, if people are interpreting tino ranga te ratanga to mean absolute Maori control, somehow that's got to reconcile with Article 1 of the treaty, which is about the right of the government to govern. At the very least, even if we leave the sovereignty thing aside, Article 1 says the government has the right to govern. Somehow those two things have got to reconcile. And so the notion that that New Zealand's future might be as a Maori state and a New Zealand state doesn't hang well with the treaty, which wasn't about that. It hangs quite well with the Declaration of Independence, which was about a Maori nation state. But the treaty was about a single nation state within which certain guarantees and certain rights would be protected and respected. So I think the focus just on that article in isolation of the others, and some people have used that as an argument for total Maori independence, where Maori might pull away from the nation of New Zealand and form the Maori nation, Maori nation state. Now, I think if you went and surveyed 100 Maori people out in the street of Hamilton, probably, a bit hard to judge Hamilton, but if you surveyed 100 Maori people, most would say we're not talking about a separate Maori nation state where you need a passport to go from one part of New Zealand to the other. We're not talking about that. We're talking about being able to retain an element of autonomy, at least in respect of our own affairs, so that it's not lost entirely as not subjected entirely to bureaucratic interference. Now, I think that's, for most people, that's what tino ranga te ratanga would mean. Whether it's delivering a health service, if we deliver our own health services, much more chance they'll be used, get to the people who need it. It might be in respect of management of your own land. So that I think it's, in some ways, you see, that message that autonomy and that communities should have their own autonomy, well, I mean, Roger Douglas was right at home with that conversation. Because the far right, which we sometimes used to call the loony right, was actually quite supportive of that notion that minimal interference from the government. So I think the point is that I think the idea of a separatist Maori state is not a mainstream Maori view, although it is a Maori view. There are some people who espouse it. In the at Whanganui, when the gardens were occupied, That shaped up to be a talk in the end, and largely from one or two protagonists. Ken Mayer, for example, was one. He was arguing in that line, in that direction, I think. It's a bit hard to tell. He changed his argument from time to time. But I think the argument was of a separate Māori state. It would be very difficult to have a separate Māori state, particularly unless you have it without having a geographical state, you know, so that... I mean, you sort of split, you take the North Island, we'll take the South, or the other way around. It'd be fairly difficult, I think, to do. On the other hand, the question of autonomy is quite consistent with the movement in many countries about where, that Indigenous people want to have more say in managing their own affairs. So there's a difference, I think, between autonomy and a separate Māori state. I think it would be pretty hard for a separate Māori state to work. I also think the Crown would not allow it. I think that... See, there's this draft declaration of the rights of Indigenous people, which will be presented to the United Nations within the next year or two for ratification. And in it, it says, at present, that Indigenous people have the right to self-determination. Now, the New Zealand government is just a little unhappy about that because they think self-determination might be interpreted as pulling away from the national, from the nation state and establishing your own nation state. Other countries are taking a much stronger view on it. They say we would never allow self-determination if it means pulling out of the state and establishing your own country, your own nation. So New Zealand's introduced that idea, but I think that if they define self-determination as something short of cession from your own country, then I think the declaration would be supported by New Zealand. So in summary then, I think the Tūnoranga Tiritanga in Article 2 has got to be seen in the context of a whole treaty, which is about the right of the government to govern, the guarantee that Māori can exercise authority over their own affairs, as long as that's compatible with the right of the government to govern. That's a question, of course, how do you work that out? And the good thing is that people are talking about it and negotiating it to reach a position on it. And then the other part of your question was, is this likely to lead on to some national Māori movement? Certainly people are talking about it. The papers love people who talk about that. So that if you only rely on the Auckland Herald and the Dominion, you would get the impression that all Māori people are wanting to pull out of New Zealand, send all Pākehā people out of the country and establish the Māori nation-state, because they give so much publicity to that, when I don't think it's a widely held Māori view, although a widely held Māori view is that you should be able to have exercise a degree of autonomy. Did you want to say anything to that? Yeah.
Would you give that same autonomy to Aboriginal groups in New Zealand?
If I was a member of the ACT Party, I'd be advocating it. Because, well, I mean, that's the ACT position, isn't it? That there should be minimal interference from the government and that people should have maximum autonomy over their own affairs. What is it?
Your position.
Oh, my position is that we probably need a government. And that autonomy, no one has autonomy. None of us will ever be autonomous. New Zealand is so small, we're all intermarried and linked up one way or another. Know someone's cousin who's married to you or someone else's auntie. We're all so closely linked that I think autonomy is always relative. And that we might aspire for autonomy, whether we be a church group or an iwi or a hapu or a marae, we always aspire towards autonomy. But autonomy is always limited in New Zealand because we have our neighbours and we can never be autonomous in that sense. And so that I really think that... No, not on this year, I don't think. No, ACTC says individual liberty is the guiding point and they tend to underplay the collective responsibility, and I think that there is a need for collective responsibility. But autonomy, I think, is something that all groups aspire to. I belong to half a dozen groups. Massey wants to be absolutely autonomous. Fielding is always trying to maintain its autonomy from Palmerston North and is partially successful. And it's a fact of New Zealand life, whenever you get 10 people together, they want to form a committee and be an autonomous committee with their own constitution. So I think we do aspire as a nation towards having autonomy and not being bullied by other people. At the same time, we are so small that absolute autonomy is undesirable and I think unlikely to work. You spoke of tino ranga tiratanga. You spoke of... Sorry, I've read that one, haven't I? This one's in pencil. I was interested in Hobson, handing the responsibility of explaining the treaty to Colenso, that is the church. We haven't done a very good job of this over the years. I wonder how you see the church in this role of explaining the treaty or ministry in the spirit of the treaty. How do we do this? Well, yes and no. who was it that wrote the question? Do you want to explain it a bit more?
Just that the treaty is not about social disadvantage or injustices of the past, and if the church is meant to be, I guess, agents of positive change and bringing a message of hope and reconciliation, then I guess we have that responsibility to speak into and to act in a Christ-like way into these issues. So I'm just wondering from your view what kind of look like.
But I think, first of all, that the church in New Zealand has been really reasonably successful in maintaining a level of awareness about the treaty over the years. So although you've felt perhaps it hasn't nearly been good enough, I suspect that without the influence of the church, and I'm using that in a very broad sense, that the level of awareness would actually have been much less than it actually is. And in the years when the Crown did not want to know about the treaty, the church sort of kept it going, if only in pockets within the church. But in more recent times, I think you can find examples where the church has taken the lead in promoting debate about the treaty. Now, how can the church best do that? On the one hand, seminars like this, I think, are quite useful. And the fact that people want to come and give up a beautiful Saturday to come and talk about the Treaty of Waitangi, I think says something, that the church is wanting to understand it so that they can take a position on it, then at least be in an informed position when debate does come up. Some churches, of course, have taken a strong position on it. The Anglican Church redesigned its whole synod to fit in with the treaty. Now, if you can change the constitution of the Anglican Church, you can do anything. But that was changed largely to fit around a treaty framework of peoples rather than individual people. The critical issue for the church, I think, is not necessarily a promotion of the treaty as a promotion of the values upon which the treaty is based. And those values are fairly fundamental Christian values, which have to do with fairness and honesty and ensuring that people have the right to develop to their full and have the right to be themselves. And that right to be themselves includes the right to be Māori, for example. And in the... That hasn't always been the case in New Zealand. So that I think it's not so much the direct advocacy for the treaty that the church will contribute to as the promotion of the values upon which the treaty rests. This is a long one. You spoke of New Zealand's way of approaching the dilemma of the two versions of the treaty. Is not the 1975 Act and Tribunal a Pākehā way of staying in control? Why have you not argued for support of the contra-proferendum approach that has emerged in the international community? Are we outside exempt from this? My church, Catholic, speaks of an option for the poor, least as a fundamental biblical principle. Is this not what Lord McNair's formulation way propose? So the question here is, remember I presented three options for handling the treaty principles. For handling the treaty, one is ignore one version, then the contra-proferendum rule, and then I talked about the way we do it in New Zealand, which is through the going back to the principles of the treaty. But did anyone want to expand on that question?
Tutty from the Auckland Catholic Diocese. I suppose one of the things that we do when we talk about the treaty is we begin with the Maori text. And for most of us who can't speak Maori, it's the English translation, but not the English text that you began with. And the whole thing about the how do you relate the two together, and do you give one priority or do you try and blend them, I think has been a major struggle for many church people, and seeing our church, at least in intentional language, talks about an option for the poor, I see very much the international community sort of developing guidelines around giving preference to the one that's in the indigenous language that hasn't been formulated by the indigenous people. Would you like to comment?
You're quite right insofar as that's the intention of the contra-proferendum, and you're also quite right that there is a disadvantage to the indigenous group because they were not actively involved in drawing up the treaty. The question of the New Zealand approach, why we've adopted the approach we have and have tended to not follow the path of the contra-proferendum rule, had to do, I think, with the position New Zealand was in 1975, which was being able to make progress in a way that allowed the treaty to be brought into a legislative framework. And you see, unless the treaty is in the law, it cannot be enforced. Now, the Treaty of Waitangi Act was one of the very early acts that brought the treaty into a legislative framework and was couched in terms that were essentially designed to get it through the legislative process. And one of the compromises on that was giving way on the contra-proferendum rule. The suspicion is, and I think a fairly accurate one, that if Norman Kirk's government had put up in 1975 the interpretation of the treaty should be based first on the Maori version and second on the English version, that it's unlikely to have been passed. So you see here a political compromise to ensure the passage of the Act so that the tribunal can be established. And I think that's what it was, that it was a political compromise. Was it fair or wasn't it fair, which is, I guess, the question that you're raising. International experts say it's not fair, but the same international experts come over and have a look to see how we're doing because they see here as a way forward when many other countries have run into an obstacle that they haven't been able to progress. So it's what I referred as the number 8 wire approach. We've sort of said, well, pragmatically, let's have a go. If we can make progress down this track, if we compromise that, then it can be done. And that was the birth of the 1975 Act. It did compromise that particular issue and put that principle aside in favour of an examination of the treaty's principles rather than the text of the treaty.
That compromise is the denial of what I believe maybe the majority of chiefs in signing the Maori text, what they felt was happening for them and what they were willing to let go of. How do you feel about that?
Could you say that again?
My understanding is probably the majority of chiefs that signed it didn't feel that their authority or their mana was going to be diminished in the signing.
Right.
In fact, it would be enhanced.
That's a thing, right.
So, if they didn't feel that they were giving away any of what they understood to be authority or sovereignty, but what has happened since, and this talking about the compromise with the 1975 Act, denies that reality, do you think that, why are you not making a bigger issue of it?
Oh, I haven't tried to make an issue of anything. I've tried to tell it as it is. And I did point out that I thought the Contra Pro Referendum Rule, which is the international convention, is an option to follow. It's not happens not to be the one that we do follow. I have tried not to advocate a position, actually. That's for you guys to do. Yes.
I make a point of blowing here, Professor. That is only one principle of interpretation that's used in interpreting international contracts. And that does relate to very specific contracts, usually commercial ones. To apply it to something like this, you're going to wind up with all kinds of funny results. There are other principles of interpretation. One of which was said quite bluntly, that if there is no meeting of minds, there is no contract. And if what our friend here is saying is true, and if in fact there is a vast difference between the two editions of the treaty, then we don't have a treaty at all, internationally speaking. And that's sad.
I suspect in 1975 they were the points that led to this compromise.
That's why I'm not a lawyer.
The other thing, though, I guess we need to be clear on is that the treaty is not a legal document. It's an agreement. Can the treaty be enforced? In New Zealand, it can only be enforced if it's in the law. And it's only in half a dozen laws. I mean, you can count them at least on two hands the number of times the treaty appears in the law. When the treaty's in the law, it can be enforced. When it's not in the law, it can't be enforced in a court. It can't be enforced by a court. But the treaty as a legal document or having legal implications is, to my mind, the lesser significance of the treaty. It is at another level altogether, and that its legality shouldn't be confused with its spirit. What about the place of later new settlers, that is, last 30 years, etc.? What secures their entitlements? That's a brief question. There's two parties to the treaty. There's Maori, and there's some debate about whether the parties to the treaty are Maori people or the tribes. And a lot of Maori groups are working towards sorting that out. That's one. The other is the Crown. The Crown represents all New Zealanders, including those people who are recent settlers here. So that if you're using a treaty framework, all people who are New Zealand citizens are party to the treaty. either represented by the Crown or represented by the tribes. And I don't really see... I mean, no, there was a headline in the Dominion about a week ago when some of the results of last year's census came out. And the headline was, number of Asian population to exceed the Maori population in 50 years. When you read it, it was about there's been a huge increase in the number of Asian people in the country. The mischievousness about the headline was that somehow this is going to be a threat to the Maori population. Now, to my, and of course you can always find someone who will take that further, and Manu Paul did. But to my mind, no matter what the nature of New Zealand, it doesn't diminish the relationship between Maori on the one hand and Crown on the other. That's the essence of the treaty, is that relationship. And so New Zealand has always been multicultural. If you look at our, you know, go to Dunedin, you think you're in a different country. So we've always been a multicultural country. And the celebration of culture should not be confused with the Treaty of Waitangi. I think it's great to be able to celebrate culture, and they're doing that today in Auckland. They're having this huge Pacific event up there where that's what's being celebrated, is the multicultural nature of New Zealand and particularly of Auckland. And I think that's great. I don't see a conflict between that and the Treaty of Waitangi, although many people do. Many people would argue that we're a bicultural society, not a multicultural one. Well, there's sort of a... You can only keep that up so long if you keep your eyes closed. Well, when you open your eyes, you see we are multicultural, and no matter how much you say, well, we shouldn't be, we are. And I don't think it's about having a bicultural society. It's about having a part of... having a understanding in our society that there is this relationship between Maori and the Crown. That is not a contradiction of having a multicultural society. Although it's very often put that way, and the Dominion, I think, was mischievous when it did that. No, the Crown, I thought the headline of the Dominion should have read that with the large number of Asian people coming to the country, we will become a republic a little earlier than we might otherwise have become. Well, because I think the settlers from Asia and other parts of the Pacific won't necessarily see the link to Britain as having an important part in New Zealand's future. But they didn't, because they seized on the... as if there were a problem with Maori. Then, how can the church today, including the Anglican Church, take responsibility today for our futures in relation to the treaty from 1840 and subsequently? Have we sort of covered that, do you think? Well, there might have been another angle you wanted to particularly discuss.
It just seems to me that churches are going to be involved with missionaries, and then subsequently, like in Tauranga, just in April 1840, Brown Mission was asked by the Lieutenant Governor to go and seek the scenes of local chiefs, which he did. Failing subsequently,
there was a slight lag in the church's conscience, but it was only a lag and not a permanent lapse. That Well, what happened, of course, is when Hobson said to Colenso, it'll be your job in the future to tell the people what they have signed, that was putting it pretty clearly on the church to take this matter seriously. The church did and then didn't, and there was this lapse in quite a long part of New Zealand's history. The Anglican Church and other churches were much less active in protecting the treaty significance than they might have been. But eventually they did. And they did it in some style, at least the Anglicans did it in some style, when the Bicultural Commission went around and eventually restructured the General Synod so that there's a Maori house. I'm not sure, and a Pacific Island house, and I'm not sure what the other house is called. The third house. Is it called Tikanga Pākehā House? I think Whatawiniata refers to it as the Tikanga Pākehā House. I'm not sure exactly what that's called. But what they were saying then is that the church, in its organisational arrangements, recognises groups And there has to be agreement between the groups before you can get anything passed through synod. Now, since then, that same approach has been recommended to the country, coming out of the Anglican Church position, constitution now. This is what I say, the churches kind of did it in a big way once they got moving on it. Have recommended also that New Zealand's constitutional arrangements might also change, so that you might have, for example, a general parliament or general house and a Māori house, and that before anything goes through parliament, the two houses have to agree, which is basically the current Anglican model. And that sitting above that, you might have a senate, which is composed of 50% Māori, 50% non-Māori, and they would also have to agree before you give approval to acts of parliament. Well, I mean, it's we're just about at that position now. If you look at the Māori caucus, rapidly expanding. If you can imagine under MMP, if the Māori members of parliament formed a caucus, they would, in this present environment, control the vote. That if nothing went through until it got a Māori caucus as a whole approving. And that's a bit of a worry to some of the parties, because, of course, party political allegiances tend to be put ahead of Māori allegiances, but there is this quite strong move at present to have within Parliament a Māori caucus, something like what the Anglican Church did, although in a maybe less formal way. The other question is whether we should have a Senate in New Zealand. We're a bit unique in New Zealand. We don't have an upper house. We're a unicameral government, just one house. And the worry is that the current house, the current parliament, has no check or balance on it, that it, once it passes something, it's through. Most governments in the world do have a house above that, or most democracies in the world have a house above that. We used to. We used to have the Legislative Council, which met its demise, I think, in 1950, mainly because it had become sort of an afternoon in Bellamy's rather than an act of body. It ceased to be very useful. But a number of people from time to time talk about re-establishing a Senate in New Zealand. A referendum was taken in 1993. Most New Zealanders said, no, one's enough. We don't want another one. But I heard Jim Bolger advocating for a Senate. So was Fina Cooper at the same time, although for quite different reasons. And I think the Senate that each of them were proposing would look quite different. But they were both proposing that. And the reason for proposing it was that we give our House of Representatives too much authority and we don't provide any balance to it. Yes, I think honour is the business of the church, too, isn't it? Yeah. And under the treaty, does it sound like it sounds that Māori should be entitled to a British passport? Well, my son, who's just gone to London, asked me the same question, because he's discovered he'll have to leave within 2 years if he doesn't have a British passport. So he's making a case to have the treaty recognised while he's in London, and wondered if I could write a paper to help him support that claim. Because the in 1840, Article 3 did say that Māori would have exactly the same entitlements as other British subjects, which included the entitlement to hold a British passport. Since then, of course, Britain has increasingly devolved its responsibilities stepwise, first of all to the New Zealand self-governing colony in 1854, then to the Dominion, and now New Zealand is absolutely independent. But what it does raise is this question that if New Zealand were to become a republic, where would the Treaty of Waitangi stand? I mean, the official view now is that because New Zealand is so far removed from Britain, a British passport is not recognised in New Zealand, and Britain would deny Māori for it because they say the New Zealand citizenship has changed from being a British responsibility to a New Zealand responsibility. But will that continue if New Zealand becomes a republic, which is on the cards? I mean, there's been quite a lot of talk about New Zealand moving towards a republic. When the Queen visited here just a couple of weeks ago, the issue was raised again, and the Prime Minister thought it was inevitable. I suspect she's right. I think it'll probably all hinge on Camellia Parker Bowles. If she insists on being the Queen Consort, then you might see a destruction of the monarchy anyway. And Britain might be asking the same question, should we become a... Britain is asking the same question. Has the monarchy outlived its usefulness for Great Britain? So I would think that New Zealand will move towards becoming a republic. I think Australia will do it before we do, and we will probably follow Australia, I suspect. Then the question comes up, where does the treaty stay in New Zealand's arrangements? Now we talk about the treaty being between the Crown and Māori. If there is no Crown, but simply a government or a president, will there still be that same obligation on the Crown, on the government? And it's a bit hard to say how that would go. I think the Māori starting point on that, I think probably is that not so much that the treaty is a must, but that Indigenous rights are a must. And if, I mean, the treaty has been a useful way of negotiating Indigenous rights. The treaty is not the same as Indigenous rights, but it's been a very useful way of negotiating those rights. If we don't have it, how do we negotiate the rights, or does that put us in the same position as Australia and Canada? In fact, we are virtually a republic already, in the sense that the Queen cannot interfere. Although she's the head of state, our Act of Parliament stops the Queen or the Governor-General from doing anything other than opening the buildings, because there is no way in which they can intervene in New Zealand law. There was, but Geoffrey Palmer tidied it up in 1986, so that the Governor-General or the Queen is obliged to take, on every action, is obliged to take advice from the senior minister, and that's the Prime Minister as a rule. So if we became a republic, the Māori starting point would be, I think, that Indigenous rights are a must in New Zealand. How do we recognise that? And if we became a republic, I doubt that we would sort of start afresh and say, let's throw out everything and make a bold new start. I've got a feeling we would just carry on and take the heritage that we've got and move on with it. And I doubt that there would be any major overhaul. And I suspect that although most New Zealanders may not agree with the relevance of the treaty, that I think the government would continue to recognise it, if only because it's the lesser of two evils, that if you don't have it, you've got no way of negotiating Indigenous rights. And that is that's going to be an international issue that New Zealand, like other countries, will have to face. So I suspect that the British passport will no longer... I don't think my son will win his case, actually. And I think we'll see him home within the 2 years. In fact, we're quite keen not to help his case. So he will come home. So I don't think that'll happen. And I think the argument there is that the citizenship rights that are talked about in Article 3 have really moved from Britain to the New Zealand state. And if we become a republic, I suspect that we would continue to recognise the treaty within our constitution. And I guess we'd have a written constitution if we become a republic, which will be a field day for you lawyers. That may not be much fun for anyone else, but we don't have a written constitution. New Zealand's got a funny constitutional arrangement. Our head of state lives 12,000 miles away, comes here every 5 years. We don't have a written constitution, and most countries do, although I understand Trinidad doesn't, nor does Barbados. That we still have recourse to the Court of Appeal, to the Privy Council as our ultimate court of appeal. Most countries don't. Most countries have developed their own second level of the Court of Appeal. And we don't have a written constitution, and most countries have. So constitutionally, people are beginning to feel that we ought to tidy things up a little bit. And, I mean, Jim Bolger, I heard him give a talk after he'd been in America as the ambassador there for a while, and he said, we're not exactly the laughing stock of America, but people think that New Zealand's constitutional arrangements are rather quaint. And they just have a bit of trouble understanding how come that if the Queen is the head of state, that means we're part of England. No, you're not. We just share the same monarch, and that they can't understand it and think, what does your constitution say? Well, we don't have a written constitution. And it's all a bit too much for the Americans to understand. They were the... sorry, I forgot who asked that last question. Did you want to comment further on it?
Same rights as the British, the Queen's British subjects, and that's why I just asked, did it sound like it sounded?
Yeah, well, it was that way in 1840, but I'll give you my son's email, and you just might like to get in touch with him and support his case. I think just before we broke for lunch, there was also an indication that people might want to make comments or make an observation that wasn't so much a question. And do we want a break for 5 minutes and maybe come back and have a look at that? Okay.